Good morning.
Welcome.
It's October, which is the dreaded season of pumpkin spice lattes. No. All right, we'll make it through. Hey, I made it through the month of June. I can make it through the month of October. So, since we're in October, let's stay in Romans, right? Romans chapter 8 is where we are. We left off last week with verse 17. And so we'll pick up there again this week. Romans chapter 8. I want to read the last half of verse 17. It won't be on the screen, and then we'll jump right into 18. Paul says that we are heirs with God and fellow heirs with Christ, provided we suffer with him, in order that we may also be glorified with him. Verse 18, for I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory that is to be revealed to us. So, all right, today we continue with what we've talked about for the last two sermons in Romans, and that is suffering and glory. But the emphasis today will be on glory. And there are times, if you're a Sunday school teacher or a preacher or whatever, teach a small group, there are going to be times that you come across topics that are beyond you. I mean, in one sense, everything in the Bible seems to be beyond us, but it does contain many thoughts that are clear to us because they're explained in Scripture, but many that are not. From time to time, we come to thoughts that we know we will never fully understand until we get to heaven. Glory is one of them. And that's what we're going to talk about today. So great, an introduction where the preacher says, we're going to talk today about one of those things that you'll never understand until you get to heaven. That's encouraging, right? Take really good notes. Glory could be called an incomparable thing, not only because it does resist comparison. What would you compare it to? But because it truly, I believe, is beyond our comprehension. I think at best, we only have an intimation of it. Glory is the word that we find used to describe God's magnificence. And therefore, it's also used to describe the dazzling magnificence of heaven, and our share in that. But when we look in the Bible for descriptions of heaven, for example, the ones we're given are largely negative in their cast, if you will, in their tone. And what I mean by that is they tell us things that heaven will not contain. The best description of heaven, maybe in the whole Bible, is that description of the New Jerusalem in Revelation chapter 21. Listen to what this loud voice from the throne of God says in Revelation 21. Verse 3, it says, and I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people. And God himself will be with them as their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain anymore, for the former things have passed away. All right, so we know here it says that God will dwell with us. That's positive. But the strength of this description, the things we remember, are in the words, no more tears, no more pain, no more death, no more mourning. These are all negative ideas, no doubt, I think, because we can't fully comprehend the positive things of glory and of heaven. But we can understand the removal of those things which trouble our lives now. It's difficult, again, to understand the positive aspects of glory, but you can certainly understand what it is to get rid of all the things you hate about life now. And yet still, the greatest word for what is in store for God's people is glory. The text says, verse 18 there, "For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory that is to be revealed to us." So the obvious question is, what is this glory? And if you have any kind of commentaries or Bible dictionaries or Bible handbooks, things like that, they'll give you a definition, even though I think it's incomprehensible for us. That's never stopped people from trying to define it anyway. But all the definitions they give seem inadequate to me. And I want to suggest to you something I don't normally do, and that is, in the case of the word glory, perhaps it makes better progress with the thinking, it makes it better able for us to understand it. If we go to someone whose forte is literature, maybe even poetry, rather than biblical scholarship, for that reason, I want to suggest to you an essay on glory written by C.S. Lewis. In the summer of 1941, Lewis was asked to give an evening service at the Oxford University Church of St. Mary. And he responded by preparing the piece to which I refer. And it's available in booklet form. It's a small little paperback book called The Weight of Glory. And we'll get to where that title comes from in just a minute. But it's called The Weight of Glory, and that book is a compilation of some of these messages, and the one about glory is the first one in the book. So I read that this weekend, wanting to try to get a little insight into someone who thinks differently than I do. I don't know if any of us think the way C.S. Lewis thinks. He has the profound combination of biblical knowledge with the kind of imagination that can write something like the Chronicles of Narnia. I don't have that kind of imagination. I have trouble reading the Chronicles of Narnia, much less writing it. So let's look at what he said, perhaps. He was, in my opinion, one of the greatest Christian apologists of the 20th century. And he began by referring to a longing that all human beings have for something that can hardly be expressed. He called it, quote, "a desire which no natural happiness will satisfy." A desire which no natural happiness will satisfy. And he found in it our wish to be approved by God. And he argued that the biblical word for expressing this wish to be approved by God is glory. And at first, the idea of seeking this divine approval doesn't seem to sound right, does it? It almost seems unworthy of a word like glory. And it did to Lewis, too. When you read his essay, you'll see that he had trouble with it at the beginning as well. But he came to see that it is not unworthy of the word at all. On the contrary, it expresses a natural and desirable order of things. He says that a child wants approval from his parents. And it is right to want this. Creatures should want approval from their Creator. We are God's creatures, and we do want this approval. But the problem is, you know, we want this approval, but the problem is we live and we behave in such a way that it destroys the possibility of that approval. There is no way the way we live that God can lend his approval, can he? Unless God intervenes. Unless he intervenes to save us and to transform us, and that's what he does in Jesus Christ. One day we're going to appear before God in judgment. What's going to happen to us on that day? Well, Lewis asks that of his listeners to this sermon or his readers of the book. And here's how he answered his own question. We can be left utterly and absolutely outside, repelled, exiled, estranged, finally and unspeakably ignored. Have you ever thought about that? What it's like to be ignored by God? You remember in Matthew chapter 7, it says that Jesus said, many will say to me on that day, Lord, Lord. And I will say, depart from me, I never knew you, you workers of lawlessness. What would it be like to be ignored by the God who knows everything? To be told, I don't know you, by the God who does in fact know everything. So Lewis says that's one possibility. To be utterly and absolutely outside, repelled, exiled, estranged, and unspeakably ignored. On the other hand, we can be called in, welcomed, received, acknowledged. Well done, thou good and faithful servant. Enter into thy rest. We have words like that in the New Testament. And then he says, we walk every day on the razor edge between these two incredible possibilities. So that being approved and accepted by God is part of what Lewis says that glory is, but there's even more to it than that. That does seem a little light for a definition of glory, doesn't it? Glory denotes not only our worth or acceptance or our approval, but it also denotes things like brightness, splendor, luminosity, or even beauty. And we long for that too. In fact, we long not only to see what is beautiful, we want to participate in it, to be on the inside of this divine, heavenly beauty rather than on the outside. And this, I think, is where Lewis puts it best. So I'm going to read to you a pretty long quote from The Weight of Glory. He says, we are to shine as the sun. We are to be given the morning star. And that's capitalized, morning star. I think I began to see what it means. In one way, of course, God has given us the morning star already. You can go and enjoy the gift on many fine mornings if you get up early enough. What more, you may ask, do we want? Ah, but we want so much more. Something the books on aesthetics take little notice of, but the poets and the mythologies know all about it. We do not want merely to see beauty, though God knows even that is bounty enough. We want something else, which can hardly be put into words, to be united with the beauty we see, to pass into it, to receive it into ourselves, to bathe in it, to become part of it. That is why the poets tell us such lovely falsehoods. They talk as if the west wind could really sweep into a human soul, but it can't. They tell us that beauty born of murmuring sound will pass into a human face, but it won't, or not yet. For if we take the imagery of Scripture seriously, we believe that God will one day give us the morning star and cause us to put on the splendor of the sun. Then we may surmise that both the ancient myths and modern poetry, so false as history, may be very near the truth as prophecy. At present, we are on the outside of the world, the wrong side of the door. We discern the freshness and the purity of the morning, but they do not make us fresh and pure. We cannot mingle with the splendors we see. But the leaves of the New Testament are rustling with the rumor that it will not always be so. Someday, God willing, we shall get in. When human souls have become as perfect in voluntary obedience as the inanimate creation is in its lifeless obedience, then they will put on its glory, or rather that greater glory of which nature is only the first sketch. So you may have to get that book and read that a few times. I admit I did. I don't think in such colorful, poetic language as Lewis does, and so I have to reread it and think about it. Do we understand the meaning of glory now? Well, no, I don't think we do, not at least fully. But we do have a framework with which we can address the biblical teaching and uncover specifically what our text today is telling us. So the first thing I think the Bible adds to our understanding about glory is that we long for glory because we once enjoyed it. We long for glory because we once enjoyed it. Now, I don't mean individually, you or I did. We did not exist prior to our births, no matter what some people believe. I mean that we enjoyed glory once as a race in Adam. Adam was made, as you know, in the image of God, which means, as Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones says, that at the beginning there, he did have some kind of glory. We don't know exactly what it means. He was like God in some way, and some commentators even speculate that he may have been clothed with some kind of splendor, like a garment. Even though we don't know the specifics about what glory Adam may have possessed, we know what the condition of humanity is today. What about man's condition? He is disgrace compared to what he once was. He is a fallen being. Over our heads as mankind should be hung the sign from the Old Testament with the word Ichabod on it, which means the glory has departed. It has departed from man's body, from his soul, and from his spirit. Man was once probably a beautiful physical specimen. I mean, he was perfect. The man, Adam, and the woman, Eve, were the glory of creation. They excelled over the rest of creation in every respect. But when they sinned, physical decay, sickness, suffering, and eventually physical death would come upon them. God said, "For you are dust, and to dust you shall return." They were not originally destined to die, but die they did. Man was also beautiful in his soul. The most beautiful of all the creatures, he had a nobility that perhaps transcends our ability to fathom. But once Adam and Eve sinned, that beautiful soul was tarnished. Now they begin to lie and cheat and shift the blame from their own failings to those of others. But most significant, perhaps, was the ruination of their spirits. You see, the spirit was the part of Adam and Eve that had communion with God. They'd walked and talked with God in the garden. But once they fell, they no longer sought God out. They hid from him. And the encounter that eventually came with God came as judgment. So we enjoyed glory once, which is why we long for it so much. But it's gone. I mean, it is gone with the wind. What a marvelous thing it is, then, that we turn to the Bible and we find that the end of our salvation in Christ is not just limited to deliverance from sin and deliverance from evil, but yet the end is our glorification. God is restoring to us all that our first parents lost. And this is what Paul is beginning to deal with here in our passage today in Romans 8. Brings us back to our text. But as soon as we look at our text and place it in context, we find out that it's even something greater than what Adam and Eve lost that we are gaining. As we read in Romans 8, we find that we are to have an enjoyment of God and a participation in God that surpasses Adam's. I mean, Adam was a perfect man, but his perfection fell short of glorification. There was room for development, and it's clear that glorification was the ultimate end that was intended for man. As man, he was perfect. There was no blemish in him. There was no sin in him. There was no fault in him. And we call that being in a state of innocence. But innocence falls far short of glorification. So what is held before us and offered to us in Christ and promised to us in him is nothing less than glorification. That thing to which, if man had continued to obey God, he would have arrived at glorification. So again, this brings us to our text. In verse 18, Paul is comparing the future glory to be enjoyed by God's people to our present sufferings. And what he says is that this future glory outstrips all of this suffering. And that's obvious, isn't it? If our glory is going to exceed even that glory that Adam enjoyed, surely it's going to exceed what little suffering we may go through in our very short life. So Paul introduces an image here in the verbal adjective, if you will, that he uses. It's translated not worth comparing. Not worth comparing. Did I just turn that on to cough and then off to talk? That's great. Way to go. I'm a professional. So we're talking about the phrase not worth comparing. It's translated by the Greek word axios from the verb ago, which means to drive or to lead or to cause to move. Figuratively, it refers to something that is heavy enough to produce motion in a balance, or as we would say, to tip the scales. And so when we remember that the word glory itself denotes weightiness or substance, it's clear what Paul is suggesting here. He is saying that this future glory laid up for us is so weighty that our present sufferings are like feathers compared to it. They can't even begin to move the scales. We have a parallel text to this, and it's in 2 Corinthians chapter 4. 2 Corinthians chapter 4, we'll read verses 16 and 17. This is after Paul gives a somewhat poignant mention of his many persecutions and sufferings. He then says this in verse 16. So we do not lose heart. Though our outer self is wasting away, our inner self is being renewed day by day. For this light, momentary affliction is preparing for us an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison. Well, first of all, you see there's the reference to weight of glory that C.S. Lewis draws upon. But these two passages, the one in Romans and the one here in 2 Corinthians, suggest several areas of comparison between our present sufferings and the glory that is to come. So let's look at those very quickly. First is their intensity. We could compare the intensity of our sufferings to the intensity of the glory. Suffering is heavy and it hurts. And so please don't misunderstand me to be minimizing that at all. It can hurt so intensely that we cry out with pain or in horror or terror. But still, Paul says that the intensity of our sufferings is not even worth comparing with the glory that is to come. And shouldn't he know? I mean, he suffered as much as any man has suffered. There's one of my favorite passages. It's not my favorite passage, but my favorite description of his troubles is one I mentioned last week. It's in 2 Corinthians 11, I think. Yep, 2 Corinthians chapter 11. It picks up in about verse 23. He says, "Are they servants of Christ? I'm a better one. I'm talking like a madman, with far greater labors, far more imprisonments, with countless beatings and often near death. 5 times I received at the hands of the Jews the 40 lashes less one. 3 times I was beaten with rods. Once I was stoned. 3 times I was shipwrecked. A night and a day I was adrift at sea, on frequent journeys in danger from rivers, danger from robbers, danger from my own people, danger from Gentiles, danger in the city, danger in the wilderness, danger at sea, danger from false brothers, in toil and hardship through many a sleepless night, in hunger and thirst, and often without food, in cold and exposure. And apart from other things, there's the daily pressure on me of my anxiety for all the churches. This light and momentary affliction is preparing for us an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison." I'll tell you, whenever you start feeling sorry for yourself, you just need to read that passage. It works. We've got it pretty good. If you're drawing breath today, you've got it pretty good. Not only did Paul have an incredible life of suffering, but he also had a vision of heaven's glory. This is in 2 Corinthians chapter 12, where he says he knows a man who went up to the third heaven. Paul had this vision of the glory of heaven. And in his opinion, the intensity of the former of his sufferings is not to be compared to the intensity and the grandeur of the latter. So we not only have their intensity, but we also have their location. The second area of comparison is between the location of our sufferings and the location of our glory. And this is kind of an awkward way of putting it. I don't know how else to say it. But in Romans 8:18, our text today, Paul says that the glory of God is to be revealed to us. If you're using the King James Version or the New International Version, it says in us, which I actually think is a better translation because the Greek word that is used there is eis, E-I-S. And it literally means to, or into, or in, or for. You may have heard it used in terms of Bible translations. We are warned against eisegesis. That means putting your own ideas and opinions and thoughts into the text, right? We are to use exegesis, pulling the truth out of the text rather than putting truth into the text. So eis means into or in. The word means internally or in our very being. And so this should be contrasted with the words there in 2 Corinthians, though our outer self is wasting away in verse 16. The idea seems to be this: our suffering, even though it's felt very deeply sometimes, nevertheless, only affects our outward persons, our bodies. It doesn't affect the real us that Paul says is being renewed day by day. It is that real me, that inner me, that's going to participate in the glory. This is the way C.S. Lewis said it. We're not just going to observe the beauty, we're going to share in it. He says, God will one day give us the morning star and cause us to put on the splendor of the sun. Someday, God willing, we shall get in. The endurance of outward suffering is not to be compared to our participation in glory. So, the third point of comparison is duration. Duration. In Romans, Paul distinguishes between sufferings of this present time, which means this present age right now, and glory that is to be revealed, which is talking about in the age to come in heaven itself. In 2 Corinthians, the passage we just read, Paul calls these sufferings momentary, but refers to our glory as eternal. Now look, you and I don't think much about eternity. But I think if we could make ourselves think this way, then we would understand that there is no comparison between the glory of eternity and the sufferings of this passing earthly time. However painful your sufferings may be while you're going through them, I mean, our lives are so short compared to eternity that even the person in here with the most severe type of suffering, it cannot be compared to the glory that is eternal. So duration is a point of comparison there. I want to say finally that if we can appreciate what Paul is saying in this text and get it fixed in our minds, then I think we'll be able to change the way we look at life, change the way we live. Because I think it provides two things for us. One is it provides vision. I think when we focus on this promise of glory, it'll give us a vision of life in its eternal context, which means that we'll begin to see life here as it really is. When we can appreciate life in its eternal context, it changes the way we view our life here. But we have two problems. First, we are limited by the concept of time. I mean, most of us think of time as, what's the old saying, 70 and 10? The number of years allotted to most of us. We don't have a very long view. And second, we're limited by our materialism. We're limited by our senses. We can't even imagine the glory that is waiting. All we can think of is, well, it's got to be more and better of what I have now. You know, I drive an old car now, so I must have a new one in heaven. We're limited by our materialism. It's hard for us to think in spiritual terms about what this presence of God that we will enjoy will even be like. We need to be delivered from this bondage and awakened to our spiritual blindness. And the weight of glory, C.S. Lewis addresses some objections which people might have to his thinking, and you may have them this morning as well, when he kind of talks about glory in terms of fantasy and poetry. He even uses terms like the weaving of a spell. And he replied by saying that there are spells in fairy tales, but there's two kinds. One is to induce enchantments, and the other is to break them. And he says, quote, "You and I have need of the strongest spell that can be found to wake us from the evil enchantment of worldliness, which has been laid upon us for nearly 100 years." He wrote this in 1941. And that's not the way I would say it. I don't talk like that. I would speak rather of truth as opposed to the world's falsehood. But maybe we'd be saying the same things. So, number two, endurance. The first was vision. The second is endurance. Breaking the spell, as Lewis puts it, will give us strength to endure whatever hardships or temptations or persecutions or suffering that it pleases God to send to us. I mean, suppose for a moment that there was no glory to come. Suppose that this life was all there is. If that were the case, I, for one, would not endure anything. At least nothing I could avoid. And I'd probably break down under the tribulations that I couldn't avoid. But knowing there is an eternal weight of glory waiting, I'll try to do what pleases God and I'll hang on in spite of anything. It creates endurance. But before we move on to the table this morning, there's one more word I think we need to examine, and that's the word consider. The King James Version uses the word reckon. It's occurred 15 times in Romans so far. And we note that it has to do something with reason. It is the process by which we figure something out. We consider. And I stress it because although I referred to, you know, the whole breaking a spell and all that, I don't want you to suppose that there's something magical about all of this. Magic is for fairy tales. But we're dealing here with God's real world, and we are instructed to think this out clearly, to consider it. Paul writes, "I consider that," meaning he has thought it through and concluded, "that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory that is to be revealed to us." And I think by using this word, he invites us to think it through as well. If you're a Christian, I ask, isn't what Paul says here true? Isn't the glory that is to come worth anything you might be asked to face here? We talk a lot about Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones. He was a pastor, and he challenged his congregation with these words. "The great reality is that is the glory that is coming. Hold on to this idea that we do not really belong to this present age, that our citizenship is in heaven. This present world is passing, transient, temporary. The world to come is the real, the permanent world. That is the one that has substance and which will endure forever." And if you know that you're part of heaven's citizenry, you will endure forever as well. I'm going to ask our servers and our musicians.